The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right. Welcome to a Thursday, or as I like to refer to it, Friday Eve. Because you can tell where my mind is at. All right. I could have started the show today with a song. If it were up to me, I'd take away the guns. Another mass shooting today. This one in Tennessee at a Kroger, another grocery store outside of Memphis, I believe. 13 people dead. Oh, no, 13 people shot, one person dead, plus the shooter, who is not considered a person. And I'd go along with that. Not a human being. A creature who feels that it's his or her. I'm guessing it's a him because it usually is. It is his prerogative to kill and shoot at other people. I don't understand it. But then again, I think there's a lot I don't understand today. And we'll get into some of that. I'm a bit frustrated watching the machinations, the politics. You know, I've said this many times. And on a day like today, it makes sense. I wish we could take the politics out of politics. But you can't. Because you got people like Mitch McConnell in the mix. And Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. I don't want to put all the blame on the Republicans because there's plenty of plain blame to go around. And much of the blame falls on what Howie Klein refers to as the Republican side of the Democratic Party. And that's who these people are. So yesterday, Joe Biden had three separate meetings at the White House. The first was with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. The second was with what the media insists on calling the moderates. They're not moderate. They insist on also calling them centrists. They use those two terms interchangeably, and neither one is accurate. I call them conservadems because that's the more accurate description. They are conservative Democrats. I was listening to, I think it was Katie Porter, calling them the conservative Democrats. I'm just shortening it. And some call them corporate Democrats. I guess when, you know, you do the bidding of the giant corporations who give you lots of money, that designation works. We can talk about, there's been a number of tweets flying today about Kyrsten Sinema, who apparently took somewhere in the order of $750,000 from the insurance industry. Yeah. And go figure, you know, she's against Medicare for All. So this stuff, this is what goes on. So as we talk about all the time, what we need to do is elect people who are real progressives, who will not hesitate to work for us and will not, you know, will not sell their votes to the highest bidder, who will not, decide to, ignore their conscience, if they even have one, and vote for their biggest donors, for their priorities over ours. So, you know, it's Thursday. Howie Klein is usually here. Today he had a doctor's appointment. And what he asked, he's like, well, can I give you, can we bring on a candidate instead? Somebody who the Blue America PAC has endorsed. And I said, absolutely. And he actually gave me a couple of choices. And after reading the different people, and they were all good, I said, let's talk to Brittany. And the Brittany in this question is Brittany Ramos De Barros. Hi, Brittany. Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yes. Hi. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, thank you for being here. So you are running for Congress from a district that really needs you. It's New York's 11th. This is Staten Island and parts of Brooklyn. And we'll remember that couple of cycles ago, one of those conservadems won. It was a guy named Max Rose, who's yeah. But this is a seat that's been troubled. Michael Grimm was in that seat. He, if people were listening years ago, you remember Howie talking about Michael Grimm, who's, you know, the caricature of the mobster. Anyway, Max Rose won it then two cycles ago. Last time he was beaten by an actual Republican, one of the bad ones. Not that there are many good ones, but one of the really bad ones. And so now we have a chance to get a really good progressive in there. And Brittany, when did you decide to throw your hat in the ring?
We launched our campaign in February, and we've had really exciting momentum since then. I'm hearing feedback.
Are you? You know, that's so weird because this happened yesterday too. You sound okay on this end.
Okay. Great.
And so if what happened yesterday happens again, it's going to clear up in a moment. So just give it a few seconds. And if it doesn't, then I'll tell you to go out and come back in again because it shouldn't be feeding back on you.
Okay. Yeah. No worries. I just wanted to make sure it was coming through. Okay.
No, you sound great on this.
So yeah, we launched our campaign in February. We've had really exciting momentum since then. You know, we knew we needed to start as soon as possible because this is really an organizing effort, right? This is really about not just working with the political conditions that already exist, but this is really about an effort to figure out what power do we already have at our disposal to shift the political conditions in ways that can make new things possible. And so, you know, and before that, honestly, it was only a few months before that folks came to me from the district and asked me to run. And I laughed at them. I was like, that's a terrible idea. I curse like a sailor. I say exactly what's on my mind. I like burlesque. You know, I was like, I don't think that I'm the person you're looking for. But, you know, they said to me, you've knocked doors in this district. Don't you think people want someone real, someone honest to a fault, as opposed to another kind of polished, painted politician who, you know, might know the lingo and even be ideologically aligned, but doesn't viscerally feel the suffering of our communities that needs to be addressed and, you know, isn't therefore coming with that real fire in the belly to fight for us. And, you know, when I thought about what I had heard at so many doors and our, you know, knocking doors for other candidates in the past and just feeling so angry and let down myself by people who I had hopes for, I knew that they were right and that we needed to build a campaign that was unapologetic about fighting for people.
Now, your background is you're a veteran. You were in Afghanistan. Tell us about what brought you there and how it changed you.
Yeah, sure. You know, I think when you ask most people why they join the military, it usually has something to do with economics, right? And I know that that was a huge part of it for me. I grew up in a conservative military family, and my parents really instilled in me this love for the values that we say that America is supposed to be about. But, you know, as I think folks heard me talk about this on Howie's show, and, you know, and in other spaces, I'm also biracial, and I could look around with my own eyes and see that the America that my white family was living in was just not the same as the America that my Black and Puerto Rican family was living in. And I also, you know, heard this narrative that if you work hard enough, you can make it. But I saw families all around us and my own parents work multiple jobs, and we were still always struggling to keep a roof over our head and keep, you know, our church friends were bringing us groceries so we can eat. And I knew something didn't add up. So I ended up going to school on an Army scholarship. And when I graduated in 2011, I commissioned as an Army officer. I was a platoon leader responsible for 40 lives, and I already had deployment orders in hand. And those orders were for transition operations in support of the impending withdrawal, because if folks remember, there had been a promise from the Obama-Biden administration back then that we were leaving Afghanistan by 2014, no matter what, right? And so I was there and I was a true believer, right? I was like, this is the right thing. We're trying to do right by the Afghan people. I'm going to be going there to protect the Afghan people from the bad guys and spread freedom and democracy and all these things, right? And yet when I got there, I could see that we were just so obviously doing so much more harm than good. And I could see the way that corporations were really running the show. And I came home confused and hurt, and I felt betrayed by the people who sent me there, you know, believing that I would be doing something good, and then only to realize that, you know, I didn't know what I would, I had, why I really had gone there yet. I hadn't made sense of it, but I knew I hadn't helped, right? And that was devastating. And it took me a while to really kind of make sense, but I think I had this hunger to serve still that was unfulfilled. And I ended up getting involved in economic and racial justice work. And that put me on the path to really reckon with the systems at play that were, you know, I think really driving that war, as opposed to what we're often told about military actions like that.
So you served one tour. What? How long were you in the military? I don't know the vernacular. I'm not.
Yeah,
a military
no worries. Person. I was in the military a little over 8 years.
Oh, wow.
Because I had a reserve contract.
Oh.
Yeah. So a lot of people don't realize when you sign a contract to get a scholarship to pay for college when you're 18, you're signing a contract at 18 that you won't be free of until you're 30.
Oh.
In most cases, in many cases. And that's kind of wild, right? That we had the 18-year-olds' brains aren't even formed. They're
right.
Not fully formed yet. And so, you know, and you're saying I agree to potentially kill and die for the government in order to pay for my education, right? That's wild that that's how our system is set up.
Right.
I think we should change that.
Yes. You know, it's interesting. We've been watching the Muhammad Ali, Ken Burns series, and his, you know, his reason for not, you know, for not, not showing up when he was drafted was, why would I want to kill those people? They never called me the N word. You know, why? I have nothing. Why would I ever go over there and do this? So, I mean, it's a question that I think a lot of people should be asking. So, but I'm interested in, I just read that you got out of the military. But then in 2018, the Army launched an investigation into you for speaking out against the military-industrial complex. I have a speech that you delivered that was very emotional. And it's this speech that made them launch an investigation into you?
So that speech caused them to make their first kind of threats. So, yeah, I was still in the reserves, but I had gotten in, because of the contract, right? I had this contract. So for a lot of times I had never met anyone in the anti-war movement. I had never heard of an anti-war veteran, let alone troop. Right.
Wow.
And so, right. It's a reminder that I come back to a lot to remember how much we don't reach the unorganized, right. And how important it is for us to be thinking about how to do that. But it was actually when Colin Kaepernick took a knee, was when I put all the pieces together. Because remember, I was doing this economic and racial justice work. I got my first nonprofit job. I was showing up to protests and things like that, but I wasn't in movement, right? I hadn't really connected in that way. And when Colin Kaepernick took a knee, I watched the flag and veterans, me, right? Basically be weaponized against this man for standing up for the very freedoms that I was told I was signing up for the military to protect, right? And it just hit me like a lightning bolt that we would never address issues of racial justice, economic justice, gender justice, if we didn't deal with this kind of plastic knee-jerk patriotism, right? And really what it is nationalism. And you know, I suddenly saw the connections in a way I never really had made the connections before. I just jumped in with both feet. I was, you know, searching for where are people talking about the connections to these things. And I found the Poor People's Campaign.
Uh-huh.
And I got very involved in the Poor People's Campaign because they were building on, you know, Reverend Dr. King's original kind of framework of the interlocking evils being poverty, racism, and militarism. And, you know, I became one of the founding coordinating committee members for the New York Poor People's Campaign. And I ended up working on the national team for a while and just really learning so much about how do we organize us, right? And just kind of organizing and building unity of the poor and dispossessed being a core goal.
Uh-huh.
And I also joined About Face, Veterans Against the War, which is formerly known as Iraq Veterans Against the War.
Sure.
And I got very involved. And then I met all of these other anti-war veterans. I heard these stories of other people who had gone to jail in order to just tell the basic truth or refuse to participate in things they didn't believe in. I had never heard of anything like that before. And then I watched the documentary Sir No Sir. And if anyone hasn't watched that, I recommend it. And my mind was blown. I mean, it was just one of those life-changing moments where you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I didn't know any of this. And all this time I've been going through these motions, telling myself I didn't have a choice, that I had to just keep my head down and do my time. And look at this legacy that I knew nothing about. And then I knew that I had to take a stand. And so I didn't know how to do that, but I had given that speech as part of our wrap up to the 40 days of action to kick off the next phase of the campaign. And that was the first time I got called into my commander's office. And he said, you know, Captain Ramos, we're getting complaints about your social media, is what he said. And I said, okay. And he said, you need to be careful. And I was like, I'll continue to not do anything illegal. And he just kind of looked at me and was like, okay. So that was that, but I was kind of on notice, you know, and then I had training orders for 2 weeks. So then I was being brought onto federal orders, which is just a normal part of the cycle when you're a reservist, is that's typical. And I was like, I don't need to do anything to, you know, like I could not show up, but what would that accomplish? You know? And I was like, I think it's more powerful for me to keep doing my job, keep being a good officer. And part of being a good officer means continuing to tell the truth. And so I did that. And I posted one fact. I did research and I tried to pick facts that were just self-explanatory, right? That didn't need a lot of, and I made graphics with them, and I scheduled them to post one every day on my social media. And they said things like, you know, the DOD is burning 10.3 million gallons of oil per day. We are bombing 7+ countries at that time. And they all happen to be poor, Black, Brown, Muslim countries, you know, and just so on. You know, we killed somewhere in the ballpark of 4,000 to 5,000 Afghan civilians in 2014. In 2018, the count, you know, or the previous year, it was like 9,000 civilians. Things like that illustrate that people, you know, didn't even realize that we're just killing thousands and thousands of civilians every year. With it's barely making a headline, right? And that's when I got put under investigation.
So this speech, and I actually want to play it. It's only about 3 minutes or so. But I noticed standing right behind you is the Reverend Dr. William Barber. Now, I first learned of Dr. Barber, almost 10 years ago. When he first really appeared on the scene and started talking, and I saw him at a couple of different events. One, I forget which one it was, in DC, and then Netroots Nation he came to, and I became like, here I am, atheist Jew, loving this guy and saying, this is my man. And so this was at a Poor People's Campaign. When was this? Was this in 2018?
Yes. I believe so.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, it's kind of self-explanatory and it tells us a little bit more about you. So it's Brittany Ramos de Barros. She is running for Congress from New York's 11th district. And this is a speech that got her in a little hot water with the military. And I thank you for standing up for what's right here. All right. So let's have a listen to this.
About Face.
My name is Brittany Ramos de Barros. I'm a woman, I'm white, I'm Latina, I'm Black, I'm queer, and I'm a combat veteran. As a person existing at the intersections of these identities, I carry a grave conviction in my core that there can be no true economic, racial, gender liberation without addressing the militarism that is strangling the morality and empathy out of our society. For decades, we have been lulled into complacency and inattention as our drones have obliterated weddings, funerals, religious ceremonies, ordinary homes, and ordinary people. It is no mistake that we are waging war in at least 7 countries, and all of them are mostly impoverished Black, Brown, and Muslim countries. The same systems that shame and dehumanize us based on our skin color and our documentation status or bank account here want us to believe that those injustices have nothing to do with us. They want us to believe the lie that the precious lives of our soldiers are being spent for the protection of our freedoms. But I spent a year witnessing the bravery and beauty of the Afghan people. Men and women, fathers and mothers, risking their lives and their families to overcome oppressive organizations that we funded and enabled. I cannot forget their faces. This is a racial justice issue. This is a gender justice issue. This is an economic justice issue. We begrudge the poor for the pennies we give them to eat and survive, but cheer for the nearly $600 billion annually we spend on defense. The military-industrial complex is literally corporate greed weaponized. The United States government is the largest weapons dealer in the world and the largest user of those weapons. From the militarized equipment in which our police forces and federal agencies are clad, to the large percent of current and former soldiers conditioned for war and then hired to occupy our streets to keep peace, is it any wonder that our neighborhoods are treated like combat zones and our neighbors treated like combatants? From the toxic masculinity that objectifies our bodies as nothing more than weapons or toys, to the nationalism that tears us away from the true patriotism that is demanding that America live up to the dream that it has always been. These wars are immoral. Profiting off of killing is immoral. It is time to stand up, and we won't be silent anymore.
Brittany Ramos de Barros, you are incredible. That was, and then Reverend Barber comes up and speaks a bit. I will post that video on the blog today with the podcast today at NicoleSandler.com/9-23-21, the date, that's the format. But that's amazing. At that point, you were just beginning to get active in the movement. You were just meeting these people and finding people that you were compatible with, that you had the same, and not knowing that was even a thing before.
Yeah, I was probably about a year into, you know, what was a really rapid crash course in organizing. And I think I had a head start in the sense that I had a lot of the pieces of analysis before, and I just hadn't like put them all together into an analysis that kind of understood the structures that we're living within, right? I had all of these pieces. And so once it clicked, I was, you know, I was off to the races, I guess, but no pun intended. but yeah, that was.
And here we are. So today you are officially running for Congress. I'm guessing when you went off to Afghanistan, that was the furthest thing from your mind, that one day you'd run for Congress.
Yes. Yeah. And I think when I was a kid, I was a debate nerd and I was really into you know, trying to understand politics and what was going on, you know, from a debater perspective. And so I thought when I was really young that maybe someday I would want to run. But certainly when I joined the military and even more so when I came back, I mean, I honestly, there was so long where I just didn't even know if I would get back on my feet, if I would ever feel even remotely like myself again. Wow. And I was very disillusioned, you know, I felt, and, you know, you remember I deployed under, you know, Obama Biden, I felt so it wasn't a party thing for me either. I felt really betrayed by both political parties. And for a long time, I wanted nothing to do with electoral politics, you know, and I certainly was not interested in running for office or thinking that I would ever want to do something, you know, in that arena.
And this district is a tough one. Staten Island is pretty conservative. How have you been received so far?
I think I've been received really well. It's been really exciting to see how much momentum and just to just talk, especially to young folks who are, you know, I hear so many stories when I'm out and about at community events and people will come up to me and say, I've never donated to a political campaign or I've never been involved in a campaign. I've never been excited about a candidate before. And I'm so excited about your campaign, you know, and that means the world, because what I say over and over is that truly for me, this campaign is not really about me. I'm not some kind of like hero savior person who's like super special, you know, like I think I'm special. My mom thinks I'm special, you know,
we but think like, you're special.
I'm not, but you know, it's not really about that. No. That's not really what we're doing here, right? What we're doing here is really about, for me, it's about organizing in this community that has been mocked and been the butt of New York City's joke for a long time. We've been really abandoned and left behind for a long time. And I think that Staten Island is less conservative than it is anti-establishment.
Huh.
And that's why I think I felt right at home here, is that because this is a place where the, you know, the party loyalty on either side is not particularly high compared to a lot of places. Most folks, you know, even when they're registered with one party or the other, they're kind of, they feel it has a very independent streak.
Mm-hmm.
And I get that. I was that person for most of my life. I refused to register with the party. Right. And I think that people have needed someone who can meet them in that and not try to paper over the fact that that is for good reason that people feel that way. Right. And just tell the truth about, yeah, these things out here are a real problem, but also talk about what's possible. Right. And that's what I think we've gotten stuck sometimes. You know, we all know there's all these problems and then we feel betrayed by these candidates who come up and say, oh, I'm going to do all these great things. I have all this great experience and blah, 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 blah. But the reality is, the problems that we're suffering from can't be addressed in a couple years. They can't. We need change all the way at the roots. We have to change the systems and structures that create our poverty, that drive the crumbling of our schools and our infrastructure, right? All of these things in a really holistic way. And that means that the only way I think to run with integrity in a place like this is to just be real about that and say that what we're building is not something that's about quick fixes. What we're electing, right? We are all running for office. We're all running for office and we're running so that we're going to have someone to fight for us. But at the end of the day, the movement of people power is the only thing that really has the kind of power that it's going to take to keep carrying these things forward. Because even if there was a short movement, the way that happens on a lot of campaigns, and I got elected, but then people went back to business as usual, that's not going to help anyone.
Right.
Because I'm just one person, even if I'm in a position of power. So people power. That's right.
Well, and your website is brittanyforthepeople.org. It's Brittany, two T's, A-N-Y, forthepeople.org, all spelled out. I'll put all that on the blog as well. I got to ask, you've had a number of other progressives from the New York City area win their races in recent cycles. Have you spoken to AOC or Jamal Bowman or any of the others in New York, from New York?
I actually got to speak with AOC for a little while on the Capitol steps when we were there with, you know, Cori Bush's courageous and incredible protest force the president to extend the housing eviction moratorium.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just happened to have the opportunity to chat with her while I was there for a couple nights with a delegation from Staten Island. We brought a delegation from the district and also of housing organizers from around the city. And it was a great experience. And we won, you know, but yeah, so I got to meet her briefly. I haven't had a chance to sit down with Jamal Bowman yet, although, you know, I hope that I get a chance soon. And, you know, and also, you know, I think we're going to need, our district is very different from the rest of the, of New York City. And it's important, you know, it's much more like a district in Georgia or North Texas than it is, you know, other parts of the city. And, but we can do this. You know, I think that some of the things I didn't mention earlier are that a lot of people don't realize that in our district, registered Democrats outnumber registered Republicans almost 2 to 1.
Wow.
Almost 2 to 1. And that's not counting the like 150,000 potential voters who are disengaged from the process. And I think a lot of them are people who were like me, who, you know, maybe if someone had knocked on their door and said, hey, here's something to believe in, here's why you should register, right? They would have done it. But no one has done that, right? For years I lived here and no one ever asked me to register as a Democrat. And, you know, there just hasn't really been that work to really focus on our base. And when Democrats have run, they've believed that they have to kind of try to be all things to all people. And they really prioritize a strategy that tries to flip conservative swing voters, right? So the strategy then is like flipping someone else's base, essentially, instead of really building and consolidating and energizing our own base. And I think that that's why we don't have a organized base. And so that's the work that I think we have to do, because we already do actually have the numbers.
Good. Well, and you're in nice and early, so you've got time to get the message out and to knock on those doors and do all that. Brittany, it's so great to meet you. We've got time before the election. I'm sure you'll be back. In the meantime, follow Brittany on Twitter at Britt, B-R-I-T-T, number 4, Congress, Britt for Congress. And the website again is Brittany ForThePeople.org. I'm so excited about your candidacy and your campaign and seeing you in Congress. We need you. We really, seeing what's going on there today, I'm ready to rip my hair out. We so need you and more voices like yours. So thank you for running. Great to meet you. And we will stay in touch. Brittany for Congress. Yeah.
Thank you so much. And, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that, you know, when you're a working class, especially woman of color candidate running in a swing district, you know, we need all the support we can get. And our next fundraising deadline is coming up on the 30th. And it's really important that we have our third quarter filing finish strong, just like our other ones have. And so, you know, this is a grassroots campaign. We're not taking corporate PAC money. We're not taking real estate developer money. And so that means we need everyone out there who believes in this kind of political project, who wants to advance these values and these goals, to really put people and the planet over corporate profit, right? To support us. And so, you know, you can donate on our website. Please make a contribution before that deadline if you're able. Whatever you can do is, you know, is helpful. Everything from $5, you know, to
whatever,
$5,000,
right.
You know.
Yes.
All of it helps, all of it makes a difference, and all of it you can trust that we're putting to work building a campaign that is not just about you know, a personality, but is about a real movement. And that is part, that is, you know, important as we build our collective movements across the country. And the results of that are going to affect all of us. So please consider making a contribution if you're able. And there's, you can also sign up to volunteer, and there's all kinds of other ways to support.
Absolutely. I know we have a number of listeners in your district. I know certainly of one in Brooklyn, because your district encompasses parts of Brooklyn as well, who was very upset that Howie was so down on Max Rose, but he was terrible. That's why he didn't win re-election, because he wasn't doing what the people needed him to do. You're the kind of candidate we need. So Brittany Ramos DeBarros and Mona, if you're listening, see, it is possible to get a great candidate from your district. All right. Brittany, great to meet you. I know you need to run, because you got stuff to do. You're busy. So thank you so much for joining us today, and we will talk again.
Thank you so much for having me. Take good care.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye. How cool is that? We need more candidates like Brittany, and so we need to support the candidates who are like Brittany, running. So if you're in a position to donate or volunteer, by all means do. Because seeing what's going on in Congress today is more frustrating than, well, than anything else recently. Let me share with you. By the way, phone lines are now open because the rest of the hour is just us because we don't have Howie today. So 954-889-6410, or you can Skype in to Nicole Sandler, all one word. Yeah. Oh, is Pete Davidson supporting her? He's the king of Staten Island. I don't know, but that's worth looking into because he should. But I know the power of celebrity is good, and he could get young people perhaps involved. Whatever. She's exactly what we need. So let me tell you a little bit about what has transpired today. So when the day began, we came off of yesterday, when Joe Biden had three meetings, as I was telling you before Brittany came on. So the first was with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. The second was with the conservadems. And then the third meeting was with members of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And they're both bicameral. So there were House members and senators, right? And I hate relying on Politico for this, but I'm going to read it because they're the only ones. Oh, sorry. I just missed a call. Whoever that was who called, call back in. I'm sorry. I didn't look up and see the phone call coming in. You know what? I'll bring the level up on the phone pot just a tiny bit. So when it does ring, I'll hear it. Sorry for who was ever call I just missed. Who was it? Oh, it was Pam. Who was it? Okay. Well, let's start with someone from the 510 area code. Hi, who's this?
I'm going to read it.
Okay. Somebody, you need to turn down your volume. This is Pam from San Bernardino. Hey, Pam.
Down your volume. This is Pam.
Oh, Pam, turn down your volume.
Hi, Nicole.
Yes, hi. Pam, can you hear me? Uh-oh. I hope I'm not having the same phone problems I had last week.
Uh-oh.
Okay. Pam? Uh-oh. All right, so I wonder if my phone is still messed up. It wasn't messed up because I fixed it. I don't know what happened there. Well, we'll try it again with the next call that comes in, and if that doesn't work, then I'm afraid I'm still having phone problems. But so let me tell. So I hate reading from Politico, but I'm not seeing this kind of coverage anywhere else. Okay, so Pam is calling back. Hi, Pam. Can you hear me? I guess Pam can't hear me. Why can't she hear me? Yeah, Pam, I'm here. Hold on one second. I want to find out why you're not hearing me. Pam, do you hear me now? No, she's not hearing me. I don't know why. Okay. I'm sorry. There's a weird phone thing going on. You know what? I'm going to close it out here. And I'm going to try to open up my phone on the other computer and see if that works. I know this is such great radio, but sorry, this is what happens when I don't have a producer or anybody doing the technical stuff for me. But I'm going to see if I can't. You know what? I may not even have it on this computer. All right. I'm sorry. I guess we're not taking phone calls today. God, that makes me angry. All right. You know what? I'm going to play a video in a moment, and when I do that, I'll try to mess with the sound and see what happens. But I don't want to screw up the sound. Anyway, so let me get to what I've been trying to share with you from Politico. So this, and they have a morning playbook and then they have the afternoon playbook. And so what they're saying is in the afternoon playbook, this is what they wrote. Playbook has learned that during an intense meeting at the White House on Wednesday, Representative Pramila Jayapal broke into tears. I don't know why they have to go there. I probably shouldn't read this part. Broke into tears while arguing her case to Joe Biden that the reconciliation bill should include a pathway to citizenship for Dreamers, essential workers, and farm workers. During the Oval Office meeting, several prominent Hill progressives argued forcefully for a robust reconciliation package. Jayapal, who heads the Congressional Progressive Caucus, advocated for the inclusion of major immigration provisions, and toward that end used her own story as a selling point. She said, quote, "I'm the first South Asian woman ever elected to the House and one of only two dozen immigrants in Congress. As an immigrant woman of color, I just want to share my perspective." And this comes to us through her spokesperson, right, who confirmed that this exchange took place. She, who said she has a unique story as an immigrant, also coming in at 16, and to be sitting in the White House delivering what would be a transformational investment in social programs, it will be a moment she'll remember forever. And then someone else in the room interpreted her tears as a sign that she was overwhelmed by it. Her spokesperson, Chris Evans, said, it's hard to get overwhelmed in a non-confrontational meeting. I could see someone getting overwhelmed if they were demanded to do something, but that didn't happen. Anyway, obviously tensions are high, emotions are high, and what's going on is this disconnect between, again, the progressives and the conservadems. And, it's so frustrating. So anyway, that meeting, everybody left without any kind of consensus, right? They agreed that this was the best part of it. Let me see if I can't find this line because my stuff is all over the place. They agreed that the conservadems, I know they want me to call them moderates, but I won't, that they need to come up with a way to work with the progressives, because Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and Bernie Sanders are not going to let this go. So then what happened is this afternoon, all of a sudden, out of the blue, Chuck Schumer announced that the Senate, the House, and the White House have reached a deal on a, quote, framework to pay for the massive human infrastructure spending package that they hope to pass through reconciliation. Here's the quote from Schumer at this press conference. He said, the White House, the House, the Senate have reached an agreement. All right, what I just said. So the revenue side of this, we have an agreement on. Now, the thing is, nobody else in the Democratic Party knew anything about this. A senior Democratic aide familiar with the agreement said it's an understanding between the Senate Finance Committee Chairman Ron Wyden and the House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Richie Neal on the, quote, menu of options that will be considered to pay for the budget reconciliation package. The deal does not include a top-line revenue number or a top-line spending number. So they didn't come to any conclusion about numbers, but apparently there's a framework of a deal. Again, part of me says, you know, the cynic in me says, they're going to fuck this up again. The Democrats are going to do what they always do, and they are going to completely screw it up because they do it all the time. but in listening to Bernie Sanders and even Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, I don't think they're going to let this fail. So we need to exert pressure on the conservadems. I have a feeling they're going to have an easier time with the House than they will with the Senate. All right, Pam, we'll try this again, but I don't think you can hear me. Can you hear me? See, you're hearing me through the speakers because I hear myself coming back, but I'm not hearing Pam. Pam, are you there? All right, this is not working. This is really making me angry. Will that work? No, that won't work. Okay, so I'm trying all the different inputs. No, all right, yeah, it's not working. I'll tell you what. Let me do this, and I can try to play with the sound over there because this is so frustrating. There are a number of, I mentioned this yesterday. I played a few videos for you yesterday, and I said, you know, it was a desert. There were none of these wonderful parodies for a while, and then all of a sudden, a bunch of them were released all at one time. So let's do this. Here's one from Founder Singh. They came out with a new one yesterday. And this one is dedicated to, you know, the idiots who are trying to overthrow the government. Oh, and we should go into that as well. The 6-point memo from this guy named John Eastman. Woo! We'll see just how close they came to overthrowing the government. So I'm going to try to fix the phones. Fingers crossed, while you enjoy Founder Singh and Dolly Parton with the lame justice for January 6th protesters. Here we go. Here we go.
again. Just when our democracy was finally healing that bloody MAGA mob, thinks charges should be dropped, as if those criminals were just sightseeing. Here they come again. McCarthy, Green, and all the others will deny it, but they were out to kill. Give Trump a little thrill, pretending this is justice when it's nothing. We're sick of this shit show, and when it's time to vote, we'll toss the GOP out. Yeah, here they go. Here they go.
Okay. Dolly Parton and the protest song. Sorry, I'm trying to get. No, I'm not going to play it again. No, not going to. Hold on. All right, I'm back. that song was very fast. It was Founder Sing. I'm getting close to being able to take calls again. So I'll do one more. You know my favorite family? They're from the UK, the Marsh family. Well, they're so good. Well, they have a new song out too. And this one is for their friends in New Zealand. New Zealand, who led the world in responding to COVID. Well, apparently New Zealand is now on a bit of a lockdown because they had one case of COVID. And so this is how seriously they take it over there. They locked everything down. So we'll do this one. Since you had one, from the Marsh family. Here we go. And I'll get the phones working eventually.
You went so far ahead, not in the news, no virus spread. Cases you managed to break up.
From Passover Delta Inn. Look at the fix that Auckland's in.
Since you had one, not on the spread, let's face it. Gotta be strong, cause once it's begun.
Yes, the wonderful Marsh family. All right. So we got that done. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. They're awesome. In New Zealand, what are you going to do? And the phones are not going to work. I will get them fixed by tomorrow. Good thing, I guess, that we didn't have Howie today because it wouldn't have worked. I honestly don't know what's going on. Oh, my goodness. I think I might know what's going on. I may have just solved the problem with really easily. All right. So, Pam from San Bernardino, if you want to try to call back, I think I may have fixed the issue. And I think it was just a volume thing turned down by mistake. Anyway. All right. Some days I just shouldn't get out of bed. I think this is one of them, but then we wouldn't have met Brittany. Right. And so it's all worth it. I want to share with you what, if I can find, okay, here it is. So, I'll tell you something. Okay, Pam is calling back. Let's see if this works this time. Pam, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
And it was that simple. I can't believe, I just had a volume level turned down. Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
That's okay. I had to call you because when I saw how you speak on Brittany.
Yes.
And then when I read it, and I thought she was fascinating, but almost, I'm grateful that you had her on today because she is really, really awesome.
Isn't she?
And I hope that she will be elected. Now, in terms of the idiots that we have that you call conservatives.
Yes.
I don't call them conservatives. I call them Trojan.
You call them?
Because I think they're actually Republicans, and they realize that they can do more harm from inside than out.
Interesting. You know, and there, yeah, there are many who call them obstructionists. That's another way. They are obstructionists within the, allegedly within the Democratic Party.
So I call them Trojan horse. That's what
Trojan
I call
Trojan horse. Okay.
They're not conservative.
No.
And then the other idiots, the Republicans, they're not conservatives in any shape or form. They're not.
No.
And they like to hide behind religion. And in the Bible, it clearly says that you mustn't spew any lies, and they do it all the time.
So all the time. They're the biggest hypocrites.
The American Taliban.
They are. And I'll tell you something. Their Christian Sharia law is every bit as fucked up as the other Sharia law. Right.
Yeah. And the thing about the Prophet Muhammad respected women.
Did he?
Those Taliban's, they're not actually Muslims. They're like our American Taliban. They're no different.
Right.
But I'll let you get back.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I got to get something out. All right. I do want to share this.
What I plan to do is call all those people, the progressives, the actual progressives, and ask them to not bow.
Yes. And not break. Please. I don't think they will.
Let it go down. If we can't get what we want, let it go down.
You got it.
And the two Trojans in the Senate, their day will come.
Okay.
I
hope so. Thank you, Pam. Always good to hear from you. Thanks, Pam. All right. Looks like we've got a call. I think this is from Long Beach, California. Is that where you're calling from? Hello?
Well, that's for my phone number. So this is one of your friends, Mario, from the L.A. area.
Ah, hey, Mario. How are you?
I'm doing well. I was just calling to test your phone for you.
It's working now. It was the silliest thing. And you know what? Last week when it happened, I went and I saw, I figured it out. I don't know how that knob got turned down again because it was up.
But I thought it was just might have hit a mute button or something.
No, it's one of the outputs from my soundboard, just so you know, that goes into the computer that I run the phone system off of. And for some reason, the output was turned all the way down. Just a stupid thing that shouldn't have happened.
All right. Well, I'm challenging everybody out there I sent you a little message on Facebook, but donate to Brittany. I challenge everybody. Do $27 and move on.
Awesome. Sounds good to me.
All right.
Thanks,
all right,
Mario.
Talk to you soon.
Okay.
Bye.
Take care. Bye. Bye-bye. All right. So let me share this with you before we run out of time. So there was this memo. I guess it was written about in the Woodward Costa book, but CNN actually got a hold of the actual memo. And it was a six-pronged plan to overthrow the election, to overturn the election, and put Trump, or keep Trump, in power. So this shows you in great detail how they plan to do it. And to let you know that Merrick Garland or whoever needs to get off their asses and hold these people accountable for trying to overthrow our government. So here, the guy's name, the attorney, was John Eastman. Here is the six-point plan. Number one, Vice President Pence, presiding over the joint session, or the Senate pro tem, which in this case is, well, it says Chuck Grassley, but Grassley's not the Senate pro tem. He was before the Democrats took over. Sorry, duh. Okay, so back before the inauguration, before, yes, that was the case. All right, so I'm sorry, I'm all over the place today, but bear with me. Vice President Pence, presiding over the joint session, or Senate pro tem Grassley, if Pence recuses himself, begins to open and count the ballots, starting with Alabama, without conceding that the procedure specified by the Electoral Count Act of going through the states alphabetically is required. Number two, when he gets to Arizona, he announces that he has multiple slates of electors and so is going to defer decision on that until finishing the other states. This would be the first break with the procedure set out in the act. Number three, at the end, he announces that because of the ongoing disputes in the seven states, there are no electors that can be deemed valid appointed in those states. That means the total number of, quote, electors appointed, the language of the 12th Amendment, is 454. This reading of the 12th Amendment has also been advanced by Harvard law professor Lawrence Tribe, and they link to a quote. A majority of the electors appointed would therefore be 228. There are at this point 232 votes for Trump, 222 for Biden. Pence then gavels Trump as reelected. All right. Number four, howls, of course, from the Democrats who now claim, contrary to Tribe's prior position, that 270 are required. So Pence says, fine. Pursuant to the 12th Amendment, no candidate has achieved the necessary majority. That sends the matter to the House, where the votes shall be taken by states, the representation from each state having one vote. And this is where they could have done it. Sorry, that's me. Back to the copy here. Republicans currently control 26 of the state delegations, the bare majority needed to win that vote. President Trump is reelected there as well. That should scare the daylights out of everyone. But wait, there's more. Number five, one last piece. Assuming the Electoral Count Act process is followed and upon getting the objections to the Arizona slates, the two houses break in their separate chambers, we should not allow the Electoral Count Act constraint on debate to control. That would mean that a prior legislature was determining the rules of the present one, a constitutional no-no, as Tribe has forcefully argued. So someone, Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, should demand normal rules, which includes the filibuster. That creates a stalemate that would give the state legislatures more time to weigh in to formally support the alternative slate of electors if they had not already done so. And the sixth and final point goes like this. The main thing here is that Pence should do this without asking for permission, either from a vote of the joint session of the court, either from a vote of the joint session or from the court. Let the other side challenge his actions in court, where Tribe, who in 2001 conceded the president of the Senate, might be in charge of counting the votes, and others who would press a lawsuit would have their past position that these are non-justicable political questions thrown back at them to get the lawsuit dismissed. The fact is that the Constitution assigns this power to the vice president as the ultimate arbiter. We should take all of our actions with that in mind. The fact is that that's not true. This is me again. I'm done reading their 6 points, but it does show how ready they were to complete the coup. And as the old saying goes, something along the lines of what is a failed coup attempt? Practice. They are not giving up. We need to just double down, and I'm afraid we're not seeing that from this Justice Department. I don't know where Merrick Garland is, but he needs to get off his ass and do his job. And that means protecting our democracy. All right. Tomorrow, Friday, Brian Karam will be here. You may remember him from, he was the White House reporter for Playboy. Well, not anymore. Because, you know, Playboy stopped printing. He now writes a weekly column for Salon.com, and he'll join us tomorrow, and we'll talk about all of this and more. And my phones will be working, so if you want to call in at the beginning of the show, you can. I promise. And hopefully my brain and my mouth will work together tomorrow. All right. Thank you for listening, everybody. Thanks for bearing with me. I'll see you tomorrow. And I will leave you with the news, because I know I got something right today. See you tomorrow. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
President Biden on Wednesday spent 5 hours in three meetings with 23 congressional Democrats in the Oval Office, trying to come to some kind of agreement on passing his Build Back Better agenda, which includes both a hard infrastructure bill and the larger reconciliation package. Politico's Playbook Thursday morning offered a fairly comprehensive recap of how it all went down, with the outcome, according to one senior White House official, quote, moderates agreed that they need to coalesce around an offer to the liberals. Reportedly, when the president asked the Conservadem or obstructionist caucus for a specific top-line number they'd agree to for the reconciliation bill, they refused. The group, which included Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema, John Tester, Stephanie Murphy, and Josh Gottheimer, among others, instead argued that the Democrats should instead present an agreed-upon list of revenue raisers that would determine the top-line number. Then there's the matter of health care. And there's a disagreement between Nancy Pelosi, who wants to shore up the Affordable Care Act, and Bernie Sanders, who wants to expand Medicare benefits. The obstructionists made it clear they're with Pelosi. One source saying there was enough in that room to kill Bernie Sanders' idea. Lovely. Finally, they also asked the president not to rush the reconciliation process and to use his influence in the House to pass the BIF, or the Hard Infrastructure Bill. The bottom line in that meeting is the president told them to come up with a set of principles or framework for reconciliation that would persuade progressives to back down from their threat to kill the BIF in the House when it comes up for a vote on Monday. John Tester, leaving the White House, said, quote, the goal is to try to get a framework before the vote on the bipartisan infrastructure package. They needed a meeting for that? Well, the first meeting was with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. The second meeting was with the conservadems from both the House and the Senate. And the third, final meeting was with the progressives. It included Barbara Lee and Pramila Jayapal, as well as Senators Bernie Sanders and Ron Wyden, among others. Biden faced a united front of progressives pleading with him to use his influence to delay the Monday vote. One person in the room telling Politico, quote, it's weird if you're supposedly for a bill to insist on killing it. The iron law of legislating is that if you have the votes, you take the vote. And if you don't have the votes, you delay the vote. That was done on BIF multiple times at the request of the moderate negotiators. It's quite standard. It is not standard to insist on a vote when you know it will fail. Weird to call yourself a pragmatist and then kill the bill you say you want to pass by not giving negotiators more time. Biden responded saying, I hear ya. This according to Senator Ron Wyden. He continued saying, I know a lot of you think that's an arbitrary date. Let me think about it and I'll talk to Senator Schumer and the Speaker. So obviously no solution came out of Wednesday's meetings. Negotiations continue. And meanwhile, a group of progressive and grassroots organizations, including Move On, Indivisible, Greenpeace, the Sunrise Movement, the Working Families Party, and many others, is sending a letter to Congress today, Thursday, urging members of the House to vote no on the BIF without a reconciliation bill. The letter says, quote, passing just that small bill alone wouldn't be a compromise. It would be a capitulation. We strongly support the position of the Congressional Progressive Caucus that two bills, must pass together as a critical step on the journey toward tackling the climate crisis and furthering racial and economic justice. We urge progressives to hold strong. We will have your back. So while that's all going on, there's also the ongoing threat of a government shutdown, and worse, as Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has again donned his Grim Reaper getup, affirming that he will not give Democrats any help in raising the debt ceiling, saying this is a totally Democratic government. They have an obligation to raise the debt ceiling and they will do it. Of course, McConnell's argument omits the fact that a significant amount of this current debt stems from the tax cuts and spending signed by Donald Trump and passed with Republican votes. And Congress needs to increase the debt ceiling even if Joe Biden's spending program fails. Well, on Tuesday, the House, controlled by the Democrats, passed a bill to lift the debt limit through 2022 and fund the government through early December, as well as provide money for natural disaster recovery and Afghan refugees. So it passed in the House, but Senate Republicans appear likely to block that bill in the next few days by denying it the 60 votes it would need to overcome a filibuster. And of course, you have so-called Democrats Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin standing in the way by refusing to do anything about the filibuster. So it goes. Meanwhile, President Biden on Wednesday spoke with French President Emmanuel Macron for the first time since France objected strongly to a U.S. deal to help Australia acquire nuclear power submarines. Biden reportedly acknowledged mistakes in the way his administration handled the matter, kind of a change from the former guy. In a joint statement, the U.S. and France said Biden and Macron, quote, agreed that the situation would have benefited from open consultations among allies on matters of strategic interest to France and our European partners. France had recalled its ambassador over the incident, but said after the call, it was sending him back. Another breakdown in congressional negotiations, this time it's police reforms that went down in flames as the talks officially collapsed on Wednesday. Senator Cory Booker, the lead negotiator on the Democratic side, said the talks ended with no breakthrough in sight. At a news conference, Booker said, quote, we weren't making any more meaningful progress on establishing really substantive reform for Americans' policing. Tim Scott, the lead Republican negotiator, blamed Democrats for the failure, saying they, quote, let their misguided idea of perfect be the enemy of good, impactful legislation. The sticking point was the Republicans' refusal to do anything about qualified immunity, which basically makes police immune from any kind of civil responsibility for their actions. I'd walk away too. And this breaking news Thursday morning, the U.S. Special Envoy for Haiti resigned, saying he will not be associated with, quote, inhumane, counterproductive deportations of Haitians. In his resignation letter, Daniel Foote said the U.S. policy toward Haiti remains deeply flawed, and his recommendations have been ignored and dismissed. The resignation, effective immediately, comes as the Biden administration has faced widespread criticism for its treatment of thousands of Haitian immigrants who've been encamped at the U.S.-Mexico border. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is fully listener-supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.